Hello, I'm John Callender, and this is Lies.com podcast number 6, I believe. As you can probably tell from the background noise, I'm recording this in my car, in my never-ending quest to find a way to record podcasts without sucking up valuable time that might be used for something more important, like, playing multiplayer Halo, or some other time-wasting event. Doing fun things with my kids. This downtime while I'm driving down to LA seemed like a time to try an experimental en route podcast from my car. I'm about to get on the 101 freeway. Obviously, this podcast is unscripted and unaccompanied by me clicking around on my computer, reading from things I've said on lies.com previously, or things said on other sites that I find interesting. I expect there won't be a lot of found audio. I may or may not go in afterwards and put in some music. We'll see how that goes. So expect this podcast to be relatively random, as my daughter would say. Nothing like hanging out with some 14-year-old girls to broaden your vocabulary. Or at least give you new ways of using words you already knew. Julia's friend, who's also named Julia, is the one who introduced me to the word random, or at least that's where I noticed it being used in what to me was a kind of novel way. Although actually now that I think back on it, I think I remember it being used in Clueless also by Alicia Silverstone's character. But I noticed it with Julia. We were driving her to volleyball practice, both Julia's in the car, where she was talking about something, I think a movie she had seen, and everything about the movie, it turns out, was totally random. And random, I gathered from context, was a note of disapprobation. It wasn't good to be random. Random was just sort of vaguely boring and dull from the perspective of a 14-year-old resident of Montecito in the early 21st century. It started to get on my nerves after a while, but I managed to keep myself from snapping out some old fuddy-duddy remark about how she was misusing the language. And then I've noticed since then my daughter Julia using the phrase in similar ways, although I think Julia hews a little closer to using it in its actual for its actual meaning. I'm not sure if it's, I mean, maybe I'm just being hypersensitive. I've been thinking a lot about this issue lately, that my expectations and my emotional inclination colors my perceptions. And I guess I can talk about that a little bit later on. So I think, I'm hyper alert to the use of the word random because it bugged me when this other Julia was using it. So then when my daughter Julia was using it recently, I definitely, my ears perk up when she says it, and I find myself analyzing her statement to see, well, did she really mean random in the sense that I would use the term? Or was it this sort of vague usage that the other Julia was using in the car to describe something that just wasn't cool? Because it was random. It was so random. I mean, oh my gosh, it was just completely random. Like that. And I think, in all fairness, that Julia, my daughter, has been using it in sort of a borderline fashion. Like, she wants to use the term, she wants to speak the language of her peers, but can't bring herself to completely disassociate it from the meaning that she's acquired from her extensive reading. So she'll actually use it, find ways to work it into her speech that are, technically appropriate in terms of the meaning of the word. And it sort of serves double duty for her. It wouldn't be a Lies.com podcast if I didn't talk about George Bush. He's on vacation now. I read where he has set a record now in this, his, what would this be, his fifth year? The summer of his fifth year in office. A record in terms of how many days he spent on vacation. He's at the ranch in Crawford. It's a working vacation, as the press has been assured. So take that for what it's worth. Bush was in the news the other day for having made a statement that his critics in the the Bush hater community, of which I am a card-carrying member, certainly, had a lot of people found fault with this. It implied sympathy on his part for the teaching of intelligent design, the so-called alternative explanation of our origins that's pushed by a subset of biblical creationists as something they'd like to see taught in the public schools. It's basically biblical creationism with some of the serial numbers filed off so they can fence it in the public schools. And I don't know, I mean, my take on that whole story, I mean the story of Bush's comment about it, in which he said something like, well, I think all points of view should be taught in schools, is nothing for people to be shocked by. Those who are making a big deal out of it, I think, if you look back at Bush's record, he was making similar statements when he ran for president in 2000. So, especially for those who count themselves supporters of Bush, if there are any of those at this point who can be swayed by nature of the things he says, I wouldn't have much sympathy for any of those folks, you know, sort of rational Republicans saying that, oh my gosh, look, he's talking about taking the country back to the Dark Ages. They're going to be teaching this stuff in schools. And I'd have to respond, yeah, well, surprise, huh? I mean, this was part of his, you know, his calculated political appeal from day one. So I don't think it's any great surprise. And in the context of everything else going on, I also don't find it any great tragedy or anything to get too upset about. These things go in cycles. You know, I'm thinking about sort of the larger question of my attitude towards the Bush administration and the things the Bush administration has done. A little minor league advocacy for religious fundamentalism being reflected in public school curricula is pretty far down my list of things that I'm concerned about with the Bush administration. I've been feeling fairly fatalistic about the whole Bush thing the last few weeks. I'm not sure what triggered this. I think it was around the time that I posted on Lies about seeing the elephant, and I was referring there to the Hindu fable about the blind men and the elephant, and talking about the Karl Rove outing of Valerie Wilson Nee Plame, the CIA agent who was revealed as such in possible violation of the law protecting the identities of undercover intelligence agents. In seeing just how this story was playing out and the different positions being taken by different people in the Bush administration, like I said in my posting, it's not that any of this was really new to me. This is really just confirming information. It's information that confirms things I was saying at the time that this was coming out in 2003, or saying before that in 2002, about the nature of the Bush administration and their willingness to basically put everything second to politics, put everything second to crafting and preserving the illusion that George Bush has any business being president. And in the way the story was coming out and the details were coming out, I really felt like, whereas before I'd been feeling the trunk and feeling the tail and feeling the rough leathery hide and feeling the big thick tree trunk of a leg, you know, this whole thing about you feel these different bits and pieces, but you don't see the elephant as a whole. And at a certain point in time, it just, and for me this was relatively recently, if you can believe that, it really just all snapped into focus, where all of a sudden I wasn't looking at trunk and tail and leg and hide, and no, I was looking at a whole elephant, and it was right there out in the open. And it's more of an emotional thing. It's more of it operates for me on an emotional level more than an intellectual level. Again, this isn't new information. This isn't anything I didn't already know. But for me, knowing something tends to be a sort of fuzzy state. You know, I'm always second-guessing. I'm always wondering, or at least I do it a lot, or at least I notice myself doing it a lot. And in the course of this story about Karl Rove and the revelations and the attempt to smear Joe Wilson and undercut his credibility and the willingness to compromise a national security asset working on the issue of weapons of mass destruction and anti-proliferation of nuclear materials, the willingness to basically burn an asset like that for self-serving political purposes by the Bush administration, is, it just puts me in the place where I no longer even really question my characterization of what they're up to. I no longer feel like it's me sort of divining the truth from tea leaves. It's like, no, it's an elephant. It's standing right there in front of me, and it's an elephant. And I can see it all of a piece. You know, it all hangs together. Another analogy I used in my posting on lies was those stereo isograms where you look at the speckled black and white page and you try and free fuse it. You try and let your eyes unfocus and kind of track inwards or outwards or whatever and make the two parts of the image suddenly merge into a three-dimensional image. And, you know, for the longest time as I obsessed over the Bush administration, it's like staring at one of those pictures when you can see parts of it. You know, you can see that there's something on this side and there's something on that side. There's something poking in here and poking out there. But then all of a sudden, you know, one last little piece clicks into place and suddenly you're staring at the actual image and you see it. And, you know, your eye travels over its contours and everything fits. And it's no longer a question of, you know, whatever that instinctive legacy of our collective ancestry as prey animals, where we, you know, we look at a waving line of long grass and we can pick out the face of a cheetah or a tiger in that random pattern. No, this is more where it's like, there it is, right in front of you, and you appreciate it on an emotional level, and you no longer doubt it, no longer question the evidence of your senses, because it's confirmed so many different ways that it just becomes part of your reality. And as I say, for me, I think that's maybe a more difficult place to get to than it might be for some people. But as far as the nature of the Bush administration and the nature of what they've been doing, this scandal really puts me there, puts me in that place of no longer having any doubt at all. Not to let a podcast go by without mentioning this issue, here's a good example of what I'm comparing it to. The thing about whether Bush is wired, whether Bush is receiving promptings in his earpiece, hidden earpiece during press conferences or the debates with Kerry in the last election, you know, that's something where, yeah, I believe that's true, that he's doing that. And I know that, you know, some people find that amusing, and I find it amusing that they find it amusing. But the fact is, I wouldn't present it to them as, no, this is reality. This is hard and, hard, cold facts. Because I don't know. You know, I think the preponderance of evidence favors that theory. I think it matches up really well with a lot of fairly subtle and fairly gross clues. But I'm not going to go out of my way to beat them over the head with it. But this thing about the plane outing, the Valerie Wilson outing, the fact that that was engineered and conducted as a conspiracy at the White House, I don't think there's any question about that. Now, again, this doesn't mean that Patrick Fitzgerald, the Chicago prosecutor, Illinois prosecutor, who's Republican, who's pursuing this, might not come out and say, well, you know, I've examined all the evidence thoroughly, and, you know, yeah, there were some signs of wrongdoing, but nothing that rises to the level of a crime. You know, the statute sets a very high bar, and in my opinion, it hasn't been reached, so therefore I'm closing this investigation with no indictment. You know, I could see that happening, and on some level, I think coming out of the 2004 presidential election, I'm emotionally guarding against that pain of that happening. I'm trying to prepare myself mentally for the possibility. So I'm not getting my hopes up too high on what will actually come out of this investigation. I'm certainly very interested in it. I'm curious to see what happens. I think there's an excellent chance that ranking members of the Bush administration are going to have a reckoning for their cavalier attitude, things like truth and the law and reality. But that's not a done deal by any means. We'll have to wait and see what comes out in that. I have encountered traffic, so the background noise should have lessened somewhat. I'm now at a dead stop on the 101 freeway, southbound, trying to get into Los Angeles. This trip I'm making down to L.A. is in order to go to the House of Blues in Anaheim at downtown Disney, next to Disneyland, tonight to see one of my favorite bands of all time, that being Devo. And I know that the concept of going in the year 2005 to see a Devo concert will bring a smile to some faces, but once a spud boy, always a spud boy is my attitude. When I go back, when I think about Devo and what music meant to me and what Devo in particular meant to me as a teenager, I know this is standard fare for youth in America to identify with musicians and musical acts, and I was no different from any number of other kids that way. I never played an instrument. I was never musical in that sense, and having married into, my wife having played guitar most of her life and being a music major in college and having worked in the music industry, and she's exposed me to a lot of things that I would never have appreciated without that. But prior to my musical education at her hands, or at least my musical appreciation education at her hands, I was a very committed fan of a number of bands in the late 1970s, early 1980s, and Devo was pretty much at the top of the list. I had a friend, one of my best friends in high school, Ed Zerner, whose younger brother Jeff was also a fan of Devo, and I remember, this would have been after I graduated, but I was talking with, I'm not sure if I actually heard this story firsthand or if I heard this secondhand from Ed, but anyway, the story goes that when Jeff Zerner first heard what is actually my favorite Devo album, New Traditionalists, and it got to Going Under, the last song on the first side, he was moved to tears by the beauty of the song. And I can relate to that. I really can. And I know some people find that hard to understand. For them, Devo is sort of a novelty act. You know, it's, oh, that's that band with the Swiffer commercial song with Whip It. And I don't know. I mean, there was a review I read back, well, it would have been about 20 years ago. I was in college at the time. There was a review I read of Devo that talked about how there were two kinds of Devo fans, those who got the joke and those who didn't. And that really bugged me because, to my mind, it excluded a very significant third category, which I felt I fell into, and certainly Jeff Zerner fell into, of people who got the joke in the sense that they understood what was ironic and humorous and sarcastic about what Devo talked about in their songs and how they presented themselves on stage and in their films and other works. We got the joke, but we also appreciated that for people like us, it was actually deadly serious, too. I mean, there was an undercurrent of truth there, of reality. And when Mark Mothersbaugh talks about the beautiful people, or the members of Devo talk about, you know, the difference between the beautiful people and Devo, you know, that we're all Devo and we're going to make a bomb that's going to kill all the beautiful people and just leave the mutants and all these kinds of things. Yeah, it's, on some level, it's silly. It's meant to be silly. It's serious, but at the same time, it's serious social commentary. A lot of serious social commentary is made in the form of stuff that you could find silly. You know, look at, I don't know, I mean, this isn't a very good example of what Devo does necessarily, but look at what Jonathan Swift wrote. I mean, a lot of what his, you know, it was biting sarcasm and satire, but it was also very truthful criticism of what was going on in his day. I have no doubts that in decades hence that people will look back and talk about Devo's comments on society today, or not, but I certainly view their work in that sort of light. And anyway, having gone to a lot of concerts, not so many recently, not in the last 10 years or so, but certainly when I was in my teens and 20s, I went to a lot of shows, a lot of acts. Devo always gave a great show. Some of the best concerts I've ever been to were Devo concerts. I'm really looking forward to this show tonight. The last time I saw them were some tickets that my wife Linda got for us. This was when she was working at A&M Records and had some pull, you know, so you could trade, they traded promotional tickets from one label to another. It was sort of this, you know, understood, this little backsheesh they had where they would help each other out. And she had gotten Sting tickets for this one representative from the label that Devo had recently signed to. She had, you know, Sting was on A&M, so she had tickets to a Sting concert. She gave these tickets to this woman at what became Devo's label. Then Devo signed with them, and you know, this concert was coming up. They hadn't played in a long time. This was after their real career had pretty much wound down. But they were doing a show in Redondo Beach at, oh shoot, I can't remember the name of the club now, The Strand in Redondo Beach, which I don't think it's not even a musical club anymore. But it was this little club, and, you know, I'd never seen Devo in a club. I'd seen Devo, the first real rock concert, you know, pop concert, whatever you want to call it, that I had ever been to was Devo at the Long Beach Arena, I think. And then I saw them after that, I saw them at the Santa Monica Civic. I saw them at the Forum in LA. I think I saw them twice at the Forum. I'm not sure. I don't think I saw them any other times other than that until this show at the Strand. So, but I'd always loved their concerts and, you know, was a huge fan of their music. And Linda knew that, so she arranged to get these tickets. And I guess the buyer that she got the tickets from was like, oh, you want tickets at Devo? Okay, yeah. She didn't even know who they were, I guess. And, you know, certainly a lot of people, again, view them as kind of a novelty band or some, you know, not serious artist. And so Linda got these tickets, got this promise of these tickets from her. And then a few weeks before the show, she called her up. Linda called up this contact at the other label and said to her, so, you know, can I get those? I need those tickets now, or is everything okay with those tickets? And the buyer on the other end of the phone was actually kind of hesitant. She's like, you know, actually, these people really want these. You know, it turned out it was actually a big deal. She didn't realize what a small venue it was. The buyer who told Linda she'd give her these tickets didn't realize what a small venue it was, didn't realize how much pressure there would be from rabid fans who wanted these tickets. So, anyway, but Linda held firm and called in some chits, I guess, and we ended up getting the tickets and went to this concert, which Linda describes, and she's been to more shows and more different kinds of musical events than I ever have, but she describes this, you know, as one of the best, or maybe, I guess, the best show that she's ever seen, the best concert she's ever been to. And it was really amazing. We were seated at these tables, and again, you know, I'd seen Devo in big, you know, 40,000, 80,000 seat venues. But this was seeing them in a little club with a few hundred people in it. And we actually had we had dinner, we had a seat on these tables that were right up next to the stage. And as we were sitting down, actually, one funny story is as we were in line waiting outside to get in, I looked over and there's Mark Mothersbaugh walking across the parking lot, you know, about 100 feet away or 50, 60 feet away, just kind of glancing over with this furtive little grin. And I dig Linda in the ribs and I'm like, look, it's Mark Mothersbaugh. And, you know, I think one or two other people in line kind of saw him and waved or was like, you know, smiling, and he kind of smiled back and kind of scuttled off and disappeared into the hotel next door where they were staying. But that was a neat moment. And got me kind of giddy. Another time, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm going to divulge all my silly fanboy Devo stories. It reminds me of the other time that I saw Mark Mothersbaugh outside of a concert. I was in UCLA. When I was attending UCLA, and I was on a date with a girlfriend at the time named Holly, who, obviously not my wife, Linda, but this slightly predated my dating of Linda, or my actual dating of Linda that resulted in my marriage to Linda, although I had actually dated Linda in high school a little bit. Maybe I could actually stick with the point of the story for more than 5 seconds. Anyway, we were in the Haagen-Dazs in Westwood, Holly and myself, and we were getting some ice cream. And who should walk in but Mark Mothersbaugh? And on his arm was this statuesque blonde in a slinky black dress, and he was in a tuxedo. And I think it was right around the time that Dr. Detroit opened, the movie Dr. Detroit, which Devo did the theme song for, which is another geeky story I can tell you if you're interested in a minute, or actually I can tell you even if you're not, which is the joy of podcasting. But anyway, he walked in, and I just looked and was, you know, got lightheaded. I mean, I was dizzy. I looked over, and there was Mark Mothersbaugh at this counter of this little tiny Haagen-Dazs store with, like, you know, two or three other people and my date, Holly. So I kind of, you know, Holly looks at my face and obviously knows there's, you know, she's concerned. She's like, well, what's wrong? What's the matter? And I whispered to her in this hushed voice, do you know who that is? Look who's over there. Do you know who that is? And she says, no. I said, it's Mark Mothersbaugh. And she kind of looked back at me and said, who? And I think I probably realized at that point that Holly and I didn't have much of a future together, which turned out to be true, for which I take, you know, a good share of the blame. But in any event, there was Mark Mothersbaugh. I actually had to sit down. You know, I was so dizzy, I had to go and sit down in little chairs at the back of the Haagen-Dazs store and just kind of watch him the whole time, which I'm sure if he noticed must have made him kind of uncomfortable, that who was this nerdy guy who was so overcome at his mere presence that he had to go, you know, sit down and stare at him. The price of celebrity. Anyway, though, back to the show at the Strand, which was somewhat later. Well, obviously significantly later, since I was married to Linda at the time. The show, we get led into the Strand, and we go and we sit down, and we order our drinks and our meal, and the waitress is talking to us, and she says, you know, it gets really crazy in here. She's this sort of 40-something, 50-something woman, you know, working as a cocktail waitress in this little club. And she actually pointed out to, Linda was chatting her up a little bit, she points out the emergency exit and says, you know, it gets crazy in here, you know, they start breaking glasses and stuff. There's the door over there, you can get out of here. Because I guess Devo had done the show the night before, and it was a pretty wild show. So the concert began, and I don't remember much of the specifics, but I was on my feet throughout. I was shouting along with every song. It was an amazing experience being right there, right next to the stage. They did, as usual, a fantastic show during Whip It, which, again, for a real Devo fan, Whip It isn't, you know, I mean, yeah, Whip It is a great song because all Devo songs are great songs, but it certainly isn't their greatest song, and those who only know the band from that song are really missing out. But when he did that song, Mark Mothersbaugh was walking out on top of the tables. Walking out on the tables that extended out from the stage, was basically standing right on our table, and I reached out, and, you know, he's got his belt off, and he's whipping the members of the crowd into a frenzy with his belt and, you know, singing the lyrics, and the crowd's just loving it. And I reached out and touched his calf, you know, probably like those monkeys in 2001 touching the obelisk. It was my moment of pure joy and enlightenment. So it was my bonding with Devo. So anyway, I realize now that that's probably at least 20 years ago, and they're playing at the House of Blues down in Anaheim, and I'm on my way to see them. I'm really sad that Linda can't come. She's injured her back a couple of weeks ago and has been trying to get it better, but it's, you know, taking a long time, and she's disgusted by that. And I've just spent a lot of time lying down, but she, you know, told me this morning, look, I really can't go to the show. So I found a substitute, Aaron, who's a hero in the interactive chat environment, the MUD, Ishar, that I hang out in most of the time. Aaron's coming along, so I'm looking forward to that. So what else can I talk about? Let's see, we talked a little bit about Bush, talked about Devo. I was talking a little bit earlier about how I second-guess myself, how I tend not to believe things. And this actually bugs me more than might be apparent. It came up in the context of a page that was linked to by Boing Boing the other day. And it's a Flickr photo set where someone has posted some photos they took of what ostensibly was a shoot for a Sony commercial in San Francisco, where they took 10,000 little rubber Super Balls and dumped them off a building onto the street and filmed them bouncing down the street. And there's some, you know, very interesting looking photos of this process taking place. And I went and looked at the site and looked at some of these images. Thought the images looked a little odd, but interesting. Well, I posted the URL in Ishar, this MUD, and Servius, who's YMAT on Lies.com, took one look at it and said, oh, well, clearly that's a Photoshop fake. I mean, look at those balls. They don't even look real. And looking at it, I said, oh, yeah, you know, I think you're right. And he talked about, you know, the lack of shading on the balls, the different lighting on the balls versus the lighting around him, the absence of large-scale versions of the images. And so I started to look through the comments on the Flickr photo set, and sure enough, there were a few people talking about, oh, that's clearly Photoshopped, or that's, you know, it's a fake, it's a hoax. And responses from the people, you know, other people who said they took the pictures, who talked about, no, it was a real thing. It was, you know, they blocked off the streets, they had all this detail about it. There was a link to a piece in the San Francisco Chronicle's website, I believe, which is not so much an article, but it was one of these little, you know, heard around town kind of roundups where it talked about somebody having heard from someone else who'd seen a flyer posted in his neighborhood talking about how the street was going to be closed on such and such a day for the shooting of this commercial. And then the thing that really tipped me over into believing the story was true, that these photos really did show people dumping up, you know, thousands of Super Balls down the street in San Francisco, was that there were larger versions of the images available. I just hadn't clicked through to the right place. So looking at them, I realized that in one of the photos, you could basically see that there were some pretty sophisticated shadow effects going on, where the Super Balls near the street had shadows below them. The balls themselves seemed to be illuminated from that angle. In the column of falling balls, you could see that the ones in back were shaded. You know, they were in shadow, whereas the ones in front were in full sun. Looking at that, I really just got to the point of saying, you know, I think this is real. You know, I think I'm being too skeptical here, too inclined to dismiss this just on the basis of the fact that it could be a hoax. And yeah, all the people vouching for it are just random people posting on the internet, you know, putting up a few flyers in the neighborhood and managing to get those mentioned in a newspaper article would be a great way to add to the verisimilitude of the hoax. But no, I think it's real. And after making that comment in Ishar, both Aaron and, you know, Hero and Wymat, Eusebius, all these names, both came in with the opinion that, well, you know, it wouldn't actually be that hard to fake the kinds of shadow effects I was seeing in that image that were convincing to me. And this came up again shortly thereafter. There's another site with images online that has become very popular and I think was linked to by Boing Boing. But it's the site of this kid, this 6 or 7 year old blonde kid, kind of looks a lot like my own son, whose dad, in classic proud dad fashion, has posted his son's artwork on the internet, except that the son's artwork is actually really good. And looking at it, I mean, yeah, it looks like a kid's artwork, but it also has something else going on with it. And I realized that, you know, there's this element of this sort of self-reflexive process where art critics find something to love about basically random imagery. I'll see how many times I can work that word into the podcast in its conventional usage. But there's something about these images that really do impress me. And as I'm looking at these images, the first one that I guess garnered a lot of the original attention, which is the mouth of the T-Rex descending open on the kid with the teeth visible around it. You should look at the image. Once you sort of get it, once you realize what it is you're looking at, you realize that, wow, that's actually a very impressive picture, certainly for a six-year-old to create. Yeah, but some of the other images, too, you know, you look at them and I can't help thinking, okay, is this real? I mean, they're believably a kid's images, but they're also really impressive from an artistic standpoint. And there's this element of, you know, this sense of excitement as a web user in connecting up with these people across the internet cloud. You feel like, oh my gosh, I'm discovering the next Van Gogh. You know, I'm discovering the next great artist. And here he is as a six-year-old creating these amazing works and sharing them around the world. And there's this sudden recognition of that. There's this sort of flash mob, this virtual flash mob of tens of thousands of people all over the world focusing in and recognizing what's happening here. And as soon as I start to see that happening, I start to second guess it. You know, I start to think to myself, okay, what is this really? Is this, you know, is this an adult? Is this an actual adult artist who's pretending to make kid art but making it actually really impressive looking in a sort of an intriguing way? Just to sort of whore for that attention on the internet that I guess is the motivation of any hoaxer. And I don't know. I mean, it takes me back to when I worked for Lakeshore Learning Materials, an educational toy company, which was certainly an interesting experience in a lot of ways. I won't talk about it in a lot of detail because, like all good work experiences, some of the better stories would probably get me in potential legal trouble if I were to bandy them around. But one thing I could talk about, I'm sure, is the way that for their catalog shots, their images that would go in the catalog for their toys and their paints, they sell to the school market to a large degree. So it was, you know, like tempera paints and activity guides and model crafting kits and all kinds of things. And the head artist in the product development department that I worked in, a guy named Tim Finkus, was a great guy, good to work with, very talented artist. One of his roles there was to basically create faux kid artwork. You know, when you had some kids in a shot for the catalog, and the kids who were modeling for the shot are wearing their smocks, and they've got their no-spill paint cups in front of them, and they've got their Lakeshore easel in front of them, and they've got their painting on it. You didn't want to have actual kid painting on the easel, because it would either look lame, or it would be distracting in a way that would pull the viewer's attention away from the message of selling the product. You wanted it to look, you know, vaguely like a kid's drawing, but or like a kid's artwork, but you wanted it to look good enough that it wouldn't actually distract. You know, it needed to be sort of a representation of what you think of as a child's artwork. You know, it needed to be a good random selection of child's art, not an idiosyncratic and therefore interesting and therefore distracting example of real children's art. So having spent, you know, a year of my life working there and dealing with this issue a lot, it was an easy step for me to immediately look at those pictures of this kid who now has his own weblog. His dad has set up after the big response to his initial posting of the kid's first image of the T-Rex. I mean, now it's called Art Boy, The Adventures of Art Boy, Art Lad. Look up Art Lad on Google and you can find it if you haven't already seen the site. But in looking at some of those images, I found myself thinking, you know, I don't know, it feels like a better artist, you know. I mean, yeah, it could be childlike genius expressing itself, or it could be just an adult artist pretending to be a kid, pretending to be a precocious artist. And I discussed this with Eusebius Wymat, and reversing our earlier roles, you know, he was pretty well convinced that, no, that looks real to him. He doesn't see any reason to think that's fake. And I think on balance, I'm leaning that way too. But it's hard to know. And like with the bouncy balls, there's a side of me that says, I don't really know. I don't see the elephant. I'm seeing the trunk and the tail, and it could be an elephant, or it could be a big scaffolding meant to look like an elephant with just a trunk at one end and a tail at the other. You know, the internet is kind of like that, and reality is like that. And I think the recognition of that aspect of reality is really what drove me in the direction of creating lies.com in the first place. Traffic is moving well again. I'm heading eastbound on the 101 past Moore Park in the West San Fernando Valley. I'm not sure I'm in the best state to be driving. A little bit. My sleep schedule's off lately. I've my consulting work with my main consulting client that's largely supported me for the last 4 or 5 years has taken a downturn lately. And so I've been looking at other work. I've been interviewing for some jobs. I've had some decent job offers that I've never quite gotten to the point of taking. I'm still working as a consultant at this point. But some of those job offers involve commuting into the very area I'm traveling into now. And looking at the traffic coming the other way on the freeway, it's a river of essentially motionless cars, 4 solid lanes of metal and chrome coming the other direction, I'm just as happy that I'm not currently doing that commute on a daily basis. One of the things I'm doing as part of trying to, you know, keep my consulting business going is I've been putting my name out with some new potential clients, and actually have picked up some work with some folks in England. And as part of that, you know, doing some web development and programming work as part of their team on a remote basis. And as part of that, I've pledged myself to being as available as I can during their working hours. So I've been getting up early, around 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And I can't quite convince myself, at least I haven't gotten quite to the point of really adapting my circadian rhythm. So my sleep schedule's sort of screwed up. I was up till 1 last night after getting up at 4 in the morning. Trying to put the finishing touches on something that I wanted to get done and out to this same group of people in England. So now I'm relatively sleepy, and here I am driving, you know, not the best state to be in while you're hurtling down the freeway. But I don't think I'm that bad. I think I'll be all right. I have a history, not so much recently. Well, I guess recently I was going to say I've had a history of staying up late or working at odd hours. It's pretty much a cliche of programmers that they'll stay up and work into the wee hours of the morning, and I certainly do a fair amount of that. You know, it's just easier in some ways. The kind of focused concentration you need to do programming, or I guess a lot of kinds of work, but programming in particular, very demanding. It requires a lot of focus. It requires you to get your head into a place where you really want to tune out distractions. You really want to be building this abstract edifice and then getting it down in code. You know, you build it in your mind and you want to get it down in code before you lose it. When you have an idea, you want to get it down. At least for me, it's kind of hard to recover that state. It takes me a lot of effort to get into it. And then once I'm into it, I want to keep going. And as you work on into the night, you know, distractions go away. The kids go to sleep. My wife goes to sleep. The phone's not ringing. It's quiet outside. You know, you can really get in this place of focused concentration and high productivity that I think a lot of programmers, you know, are familiar with, and that tends to encourage them to work late at night. But even before my career as a programmer and web developer, I had a history of just different kinds of work that I, for whatever reason, sort of fell into that involved working odd hours. My freshman year in college, I went to UC Irvine, and just answering an ad in the, you know, the job board down at the campus employment office, ended up applying for and being hired for a job as a dispatcher at the campus police department, and ended up working there in that capacity pretty much that whole year. And then I moved back up to LA and started going, I didn't start attending UCLA until the middle of that next year. In the fall semester, I was working as a dispatcher for a guard company, and was basically, for a security company, and was on duty from, and was working the dispatch center from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., and was doing that job full-time for several months. And that was an interesting experience. It was something of a frontier mentality. You know, you've got your late-night radio, you've got your much smaller collection of people who are awake and doing things at that time of day, and it's in a way, it's a throwback to an earlier era, you know, because you're operating in this smaller community where you aren't part of this big mass of humanity. You're part of a much smaller mass of humanity. And then later, when I started attending UCLA, I got a job as a community service officer with the campus police department. This was an outgrowth of the job I'd had at UC Irvine, and ended up for several years working a lot of graveyard shifts at the UCLA Medical Center, where they had a program where they put these student security officers at night. They wanted to secure this building, which is a huge building with like 26 miles of corridors. It includes the UCLA Medical Center proper, but it also includes the teaching parts of the building and a lot of classrooms and laboratories and research facilities that are basically empty at night. But again, the hospital, which is staffed 24 hours. So anyway, at night, for security purposes, they would shut down all the entrances to this hospital except for four, one in the north, east, south, and west corners. And then they had these student community service officers, who were basically security guards with police radios, sitting at desks at each of these four entrances and checking ID on people coming into the building. You know, what by today's post 9/11 standards was probably pretty laughably minimal security, but at the time was considered kind of a big deal. So there'd be some interesting experiences staffing those desks. But the best thing about it, from the standpoint of a full-time student, was it was decent money. You know, you didn't make as much money, say, as a waitress getting tips or something like that, but you had these long shifts. You know, those shifts basically went from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m., which is, 9 hours? And really, you were only working the first hour or two, you know, because after about 11 o'clock, they had their shift change to the graveyard shift for the people working in the hospital, and you had very, very few people coming in and out of those entrances. It was really, it became more an exercise in staying awake than in actually, you know, measuring your productivity any other way. And this was great for students because you could do homework. You know, you could basically bring your books, and you'd be sitting there, and you know, you'd put the books aside if somebody came through the entrance and you had to deal with them. But for, you know, you'd have these long stretches, hour after hour, in the middle of the night of being able to work. Excuse me, being able to study. So they were popular shifts for that reason. And as I say, I did that work for several years, and you know, really got comfortable with the idea of working at odd hours or being awake at odd hours. Actually, in thinking about it too, my experience with that kind of time shifting my own schedule goes back further than that, to when I was a kid about 7 or 8 years old, when my father was racing his sailboat Hilaria, which was a 10-meter sailboat. The name doesn't refer to length, it's a measurement rating for these particular kind of racing sailboats, like 12 meters of the America's Cup in the past. The 10-meter was slightly smaller. It was actually about a 65, 68-foot long boat. Actually, one they were built as a class back in the 1920s. And so this boat we had, I think, was built in 1927 or 1928. But it was just a beautiful boat, long and low. And racing sailboats these days, I'm digressing outrageously here, but racing sailboats these days tend to be built very light. They're built to surf downwind, and they've got these wide, flat hull sections that promote planing. And they do different tricks to make them fast upwind. You can have people hike out on trapezes, you can shift, you can put water ballast on the upwind side, you can do these various things, and you can make them really broad, which gives you some initial stability, so you can generate some horsepower upwind. But in the 1920s, the concept of a racing sailboat was a long, low, heavy, deep-keeled boat that was narrow and was just a machine for going upwind. There was something about sailing on that boat upwind that was just an amazing experience that I'll always be happy that I had. You go out, I remember as a 5 or 6 year old going out on the bow of that boat and holding onto the bow pulpit as it was surging into, you know, maybe 15, 20 knots of wind, and the bow was slicing up and down through the waves, and that was just an amazing experience. A sense of power, of this sort of magic of taking the wind's energy and twisting it around and using it to make progress in the direction the wind was blowing from. It was just something that I always really enjoyed. Now I have to remember why I was even talking about that. Oh, because as I got older, like 8, 9 years old, I started going on longer races. And in those days, my father on this boat Hilaria did a lot of overnight racing, where you'd basically, you know, the race would start at noon on one day and you'd go out and go around a buoy that was 50 miles away and you'd be coming back the next day to finish the race. A lot of the races went out around the offshore islands of Southern California. So you'd go out around San Clemente Island or Catalina Island. And again, these races would take a day or longer to finish. So the crew would divide up into shifts, into watches. And, you know, one watch would be below getting sleep while the other watch was on deck sailing the boat. And in those days, this would have been back in the 1960s, sailboat racing, offshore sailboat racing in Southern California was nothing like as competitive as it became later. And certainly all the crews on all the boats backed off a lot of, in terms of their intensity when they were sailing at night. But you were racing, and we did continue to, you know, work the boat at night. And as a little kid, often the only child on these boats crewed by mostly adult men, I was very mindful of wanting to pull my own weight. You know, wanting to be part of the real part of the team, not just some silly little mascot that was along for the ride because my dad owned the boat. So I would tell my dad, you know, wake me up for my watch. I insisted that when they made up the watch schedule that I was on a watch. So, you know, one watch was on from 8 to midnight, another watch was on from midnight to 4, another one was on from 4 to 8. And I'd make sure that, you know, my dad assigned me to a watch. And when I went to sleep, you know, say I was on the midnight to 4 watch, when I went to sleep around 8 or 9 o'clock, I'd say, now remember, you got to wake me up for the watch change. And my dad would say, sure, sure, I will. And I'd go down, I'd lie down, I'd snuggle into my sleeping bag. And, you know, the next thing I'd remember, it was light out. You know, the sun was coming up, it was dawn, and it was 6 a.m. or whatever. And I'd get up and I'd be so pissed off. And I can remember this one time, you know, coming up out down from below and coming out into the cockpit and just, you know, in that kind of cranky, just woken up state. Here I am, like a 9 or 10 year old kid. And I'm demanding of my father, you know, why didn't he wake me up? Why didn't he wake me up? And my dad saying to me, well, I tried. You wouldn't get up. And me saying back to him, because I thought I'd caught him, he was like, oh, yeah, well, what did I say when you tried to wake me up? Because I had no recollection of this. And then the whole cockpit full of crew members, you know, the 5 or 6 guys sitting around tending the sails, all bursting out laughing and shouting out in unison. He said, leave me the hell alone. I'm going to stay in bed. I want to stay asleep. So that was my first experience of realizing that, you know, when I'm sleep deprived, I can kind of turn into a different kind of personality. But I continued to work at that. And over a period of years, I eventually did get to the point of being able to get up and stand my night watches. And then later, my father sold Hilaria and got another boat named Victoria, Columbia 52, that we continued to race a lot. And through my early and mid-teen years and late teens, I raced on that boat extensively in a lot of offshore races. And, you know, typically I was navigating, which is another story. But because of that, I would be out of the watch schedule, and because I had to be up at different points in the race to do navigational work anyway, so it didn't make sense to have me in the watch rotation. But because of that, I'd be up at, you know, in a lot of times I basically would be up all night. You know, I would be sort of an extra hand that could help with tending the sails. But I did learn this technique that I guess, you know, people in the military talk about learning in boot camp, of being able to basically sleep at any hour and, you know, sleep as long as you need to and then wake up and be functional relatively quickly. And I think I've lost some of that facility over the years, but I still, I think more so than I otherwise would be, I'm comfortable with the idea of working at odd hours and getting up at odd hours and working on too little sleep for a while. Although I do find lately that I can't push it the way I used to be able to, that I'll get headaches, you know, I'll get migraines, and basically my body has ways of telling me that I can't burn the candle at both ends the way I have been. Well, I can't really think of anything else to say, and I'm not sure how much longer my battery's going to last on my laptop sitting on the passenger seat next to me, so I'm going to go ahead and conclude this podcast. I want to thank you for listening, and since I don't have my long list in front of me, I won't thank the long list of people who were featured in this podcast, but you know who you are. I guess I'll thank Devo in anticipation of a great show tonight. This podcast is dedicated to the boys of the band Devo, or Devo, as the truly devolved must pronounce it. This podcast is copyrighted and is distributed under the Creative Commons license. For more information about that, please see my website at www.lies.com/podcast. I'm John Callender, and thanks for listening.